Welcome to the End Cramps Podcast. Comfort Day by NaturalCrampRelief.com is the first all-natural PMS cramps relief cream that actually works. On the show, Comfort Day brings together gynecological and PMS experts to share how they relieve PMS cramps and how you can feel better fast. Go to NaturalCrampRelief.com to naturally get rid of your cramps today.
Welcome to the Natural Cramp Relief Podcast. Today we will be speaking with Dr. Idris and Dr. Jamil from Twin Brothers TV. How are you guys doing today?
We're doing great. Thanks for asking. How are you?
We're great. So let's start off with a little background from you guys. So what made you guys want to become OBGYN doctors? Let's start with Dr. Idris first.
Well, you know what? When I was in med school, I was kind of debating between GI and OB. And when I did the OB rotation, I just loved everything about it. You get to, you know, do primary care, but you also get to do surgery. And there's nothing like, you know, being a part of a family's life as, you know, they welcome a new addition. So it was just the best deal as far as I was concerned.
That's awesome. What about Dr. Jamil?
Yeah, you know, I kind of would echo those sentiments. Plus, like you said, you get an awesome mix of medicine with OB. I think one thing that attracted me to medical school was I like dealing with so many organ systems and so many different potential problems. And, you know, for most specialties, when you go into them, you're so focused on one thing, you kind of neglect a lot of other things. But with OB, you really do get to treat multiple organ systems, adults, children. You get to do surgery, you get to do primary care. So it was really just the mix that it provided. And I'm a pretty happy-go-lucky guy. And so I also didn't want to be involved in a specialty where you had a lot of sadness and sickness.
Yeah.
And for the most part, OB is a pretty happy field, you know?
Yeah, that's good. So where did you guys go to medical school?
Well, we went to medical school. Yeah. We went to Rush Medical College. It's a medical school in Chicago, actually the oldest medical school in Chicago. and so we did our training there.
So I know, I believe I read that or heard that you guys did your, you know, medical school together, but you had your residency separate. So what was the experience like for each of you? We can start with Dr. Idris.
Okay, well, I did my residency at Cook County Hospital, which most people probably know from the TV show ER. That's where it's based. And, you know, the experience there was great. I mean, being in, you know, in the middle of Chicago, you see all kinds of pathology. You know, you have everything from young, totally healthy, normal patients to, you know, very sick patients. So I felt like I got a lot of experience and training. And, you know, you're dealing with a patient population that, you know, by and large was either indigent or, you know, lower income. And so you really felt like you're making a difference in these, you know, people's lives.
Yeah.
So for me, I felt like I had a great training program. I kind of had the best of all worlds. Got to see totally healthy patients, got to see patients who weren't healthy, but you really felt like you were helping people that, you know, otherwise may not get the care they need. So I think it was the best place for me to train. I wouldn't have changed it for anything.
Oh, that's awesome. What about Dr. Jamil?
I ended up going to a hospital called Mount Sinai, and it actually isn't that far from Cook County. It's about maybe 5 minutes, 10 minutes west, and we ended up separating. So even then we separated, but not that far. But,
okay.
You know, the process that places you with your residency program is one that's kind of outside of your control. You kind of list where you want to go, and then a computer system pretty much matches you. And so we kind of begrudgingly separated, but we have very similar experiences because a lot of people in Chicago will jokingly call Mount Sinai Cook County West because it has such a similar patient population. And so even though we separated, we had very similar training experiences. We dealt with largely indigent populations. It was very funny. We would actually a lot of times see patients who would go to the ER at county for something, and then later on, I even had one patient the same night come to my ER, and she had just seen my brother, and she got a look on her face like, wait a minute.
I'm at the wrong hospital.
Yeah, you know, and I'd say, no, you probably saw my brother. And so we had very similar training experiences, and they truly were awesome experiences, because when you're dealing with indigent populations, you see pathology that you wouldn't see in other hospitals, because indigent populations don't have the ability, the wherewithal to get care when issues are maybe minor issues, and so they typically don't present until they're pretty significant issues.
Yeah.
And so the training you get and the exposure you get is truly second to none.
Well, while you guys were training, did you guys, I mean, especially when you guys were separated, did you kind of like help each other out, talk about what you're learning, kind of confide in each other?
For sure. I think that was what was nice about not just, you know, doing our undergrad together and med school together and residency together. You know, you had someone who you could speak to who was truly going through what you were going through. And so, you know, be it your ups, your downs, your challenges, we were preparing for the same exams. So things that I would struggle with, I'd say, hey, what do you think about this? Or how do your attendings tackle this? Or, you know, how are you approaching this? And so, yeah, we were able to lean on one another and confide in one another. And that, I think that made what can be a difficult experience a lot easier.
Yeah.
But also, I felt like we were both, obviously we were each training in our own environment, but we almost had the benefit of training in two environments, because I would kind of see how he tackled something and
right.
vice versa. And, you know, it wasn't that he was wrong or I was wrong, it was just a different way to do it. So.
Yeah, so...
Yeah.
So, I mean, what made you guys choose to come back together? I mean, you're both in the same field and everything, but, you know, as siblings, sometimes, you know, opening a practice together and working together constantly can be a little difficult.
We're sisters and we work together. We understand.
You totally get it. No, the balance will pay. Yeah. What happened, I mean, we weren't necessarily intending to come back together. You know, we thought that if we could, that would be great, but we knew that may not be possible. Mm-hmm. But when I was looking for a job, I came across a place they're actually looking for to, you know. And so when I had the initial phone interview, I said, well, you know, just so you know, I actually have a brother, and, you know, he's coming out as well. And so it worked out well for them, and it worked out well for us. So it kind of just, you know, it was by happenstance almost. But we were in private practice together for 7 years, and after that, you know, we were so used to working together, we said, well, wherever we go after this, we're going to try and stick together. And, you know, and it provides for nice backup. When you work with partners, you never want to feel like you're imposing on them by saying, hey, can you cover me for a while? Or,
yeah.
Hey, I'm going to take a couple of days off. But when it's your brother, you're like...
Yeah, you're like, yo.
And so it's nice. And it's someone you can count on and you can trust.
They've got your back.
That's very true, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. They've got your back. And that's important.
So moving on to more into the practice. We are the Natural Cramp Relief Podcast, but... for like PMS and cramp symptoms, why is it that PMS can affect different women in such drastically different ways?
That's a good question. I don't know that we can, that there is one answer. I mean, they've done some studies that show that some people produce more certain hormones than others do. Other studies have shown that it may not be related to the level of hormones, but how people's bodies respond to those hormones.
Yeah,
people's perception of pain, other coexisting conditions that they might have. So I don't know that there's necessarily one answer for that.
Yeah, it's just
I think you kind of hit the nail on the head there, that I think it's more in different people's response to hormones. You know, like, for example, with pregnancy, you have some people who are, they don't feel like, they don't even know they're pregnant, no more than self-esteem, you know. There's just some patients whose hormone levels just saying that are, you know, they're almost on death's door, that they're fatigued, they're not, you know.
You're kind of breaking up.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, no, I was just saying that people respond to hormones differently. You'll have some pregnant patients that, you know, are almost on death's doorstep. They're nauseous, they're fatigued, they feel miserable. Some patients who are just as far as long and just have the same hormone level that feel great. They don't feel like they're pregnant at all. So I think it's just that everybody responds differently to hormonal levels.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what about cramps? Like, what exactly are they? Why is it sometimes they're, like, way more aggressive for some women and not so much for others? Is it kind of the same thing with the PMS symptoms?
I think so. I mean, well, there's a lot of factors. You know, one is when people are having cramps, they're basically having spasming of the muscle around the uterus and spasming of the muscles around the fallopian tubes. And it serves an important
function, obviously. I mean, your body, all of our bodies are thinking you have one purpose, and that is to reproduce. And so everything else is just a byproduct of that. And so, you know, the tubes are spasming so that the egg that's just been released from the ovary can kind of migrate down that tube, and then the sperm can migrate up the tube, and then the fertilized egg can migrate down the tube and into the uterus. And so you're literally feeling that cramping and that spasming from the fallopian tubes and the uterus quivering. And basically what will happen is your body makes a lot of hormones that kind of facilitate that. They've done some studies that show that some people make more of these hormones. Other people don't necessarily make more of these hormones, but they may respond differently to it. But you're literally feeling the spasming of the fallopian tubes and the spasming of the uterus as it's trying to help facilitate fertilization, basically.
That's a lot for a very small area.
it's amazing, you know. We joke around as doctors, you know. They do the joke, they say, what's the most important organ in the body? And the cardiologist will say, well, the heart, you know. Without a heart, you can't survive. Mm-hmm. The neurologist says, well, it's the brain. Without the brain, the heart can't even function. And we as obese say, well, it's the uterus. Because without the uterus, there is no heart, there is no brain.
Yeah,
that's
so true.
Very small organ that has some huge ramifications, you know.
Yeah. So what are some of the most common mistakes you see patients making when trying to relieve their cramps?
You know, I would say probably the biggest mistake that I see patients making is they wait until they actually have cramping, you know. And really with any pain, you don't want to wait until you feel the pain. You want to kind of jump ahead of it, you know. And what I try and explain to my patients is, you know, especially if you have regular periods, whatever you're going to do to try and treat those cramps, you want to start doing that before the actual cramps start. Because, you know, just with any pain, once it starts, it's kind of hard to dial it back. But especially with menstrual pain, with cramping, it's related to hormones, and it's related to the effect of the hormones on the muscles of the uterus. So if you can start taking medications a few days before you anticipate your period, a few days before you anticipate those PMS symptoms, then you're going to actually mitigate what's causing the pain to begin with. So I think waiting until the symptoms is probably the biggest mistake that people make, just with pain in general, and especially with PMS pain and with cramping. And I would kind of second what Idris said, you know, maybe a more succinct way of saying it is an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, you know. And so there are things that people can do to prevent a lot of the symptoms that are associated with menses and the pain of menses. One thing I'll tell people, and this is
a lot of it. Can you hold on for 1 second? They're calling me for baby. I'll be back in 2 minutes, okay?
Okay.
I'm on. Okay. He's actually on call, so he's on labor and delivery, but I'm...
Oh, wow.
But, you know, I'll tell people dietary modifications are huge, you know, because a lot of what people are feeling when they're having the painful cramps are mediated by the hormones, and diet can affect the production of hormones quite significantly. One thing is, when you're menstruating, your estrogen levels are high, and estrogen causes the lining of the uterus to grow, and the tissue that lines the uterus is where a lot of the prostate linings are produced. They cause pain. So, like I was saying earlier, you get this cramping from the fallopian tubes and the uterus spasming, and the thing that primarily causes those spasms it's a chemical called prostaglandins. And so, the lining of the uterus will produce a lot of these prostaglandins. And the more lining you have, the more prostaglandins you produce. And the more estrogen you have, the more lining you have.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll tell people, you want to kind of make dietary modifications that may naturally lower your estrogen levels a little bit. So a diet that's low in fat can help to decrease estrogen levels because fat tissue actually has a form of estrogen in it. So if we have a lot of fat tissue, we make estrogen. If we eat food that has a lot of fat, we're putting kind of like estrogen in our system, and so I'll tell people just a low-fat diet.
Okay.
And they've even done studies that show that if you decrease the fat intake by like 50%, you can decrease the production of estrogen by around 20 or 30%. So just
wow.
A low-fat diet, yeah, it's going to result in less estrogen production. Less estrogen is going to result in less tissue that lines the uterus. Less tissue lining the uterus is going to result in less prostaglandin production, and the lower the amount of prostaglandins you produce, the less cramping you have. Another thing I tell people is a high fiber diet, because when we have estrogen in our bodies, it's partly filtered out by our liver, and then once the liver filters the estrogen out of your system, it kind of will excrete it through the biliary tree into your gut. And so a lot of times then the estrogen will get reabsorbed right across your gut and then it's right back in your system and you keep having the same issues. But if you eat a diet that's rich in fiber, that fiber, as it's passing through the intestines, kind of binds that estrogen that's in the intestines, and it'll result in you excreting it out in the feces rather than it, you know, getting reabsorbed into your system. And so low-fat, high-fiber diet goes a long way towards preventing a lot of the pain with the menses. And then, you know, the ingestion of certain natural products like omega-3 fatty acids have been found to decrease your body's production of prostaglandin. So even if you have a lot of that tissue lining the uterus that would normally produce the prostaglandin that cause the cramping, if you increase your intake of omega-3s, that can decrease the production of prostaglandin. There's even a chemical, and I'm blanking on the name now, but you can get it from the skin of grapes. So like eating grapes can decrease prostaglandin production. And so a lot of things like this I'll tell people, and it prevents the cramping, and hopefully you're not behind the eight ball trying to treat the cramping once it hits you, because you've taken steps to, you know, prevent it to begin with.
What about stress levels? I heard, I'm not a doctor, but I hear stress can really affect your menses and your cycle and the cramps. Is that true?
It is. You know, anytime we're stressed, male, female, we'll produce, they call it the stress hormone, which is cortisol. And cortisol can completely throw your cycle into flux. And so, you know, a lot of times you'll see people who tell you, you know, when they have a lot of emotional stress, the periods will just stop altogether, you know. Or you know, they'll still have their periods, but they become very irregular, very sporadic. And that can result in hormonal imbalances between the estrogen and progesterone and the prostaglandins. And that, too, can cause for painful periods sometimes. So, absolutely. Stress can play a role. And so, you know, stress-relieving activities can be helpful. You know, exercise, meditation, things like that can also help.
So yoga and good eating.
Pretty much. That's a very succinct way of putting it. Yoga, good eating.
Yeah. A healthy lifestyle for a balanced body, I guess.
Exactly. I like that. I'm going to steal that.
Please do. I'll be happy to. Yeah. Okay, so we'll start with you since you're still here. Without revealing any names, tell me about one of your most challenging cases and what was her situation like?
Oh, yeah. It's funny. This one I can think of right away because I teach a course at a local medical school, and they recently asked us to bring in a noteworthy patient. And I brought this particular patient in because I said she's probably the most noteworthy I've ever had. So this story is fresh in my head. So it was actually a family friend, actually a former employee who, after she stopped working with us, was a family friend. And we were taking care of her pregnancy, and she had called the night before and said, you know, I'm just not feeling well, but just very vague symptoms. I don't feel well. My back aches a little bit, you know, but the things that a lot of pregnant patients have.
Yeah.
So my wife's a labor and delivery nurse, so she went by, checked on her, said, oh, you know, gave her some generic advice, you know, Tylenol, rest, so on and so forth. Next morning, she calls around 3 or 4 and said, I'm really in pain. I can barely move. I don't know what's going on. We said, you know, get to the hospital. By the time she gets to the hospital, the ER nurse calls us, and this is rare. Normally the ER will triage the patient, send them up to labor and delivery. But she calls and says, I'm sending your patient up to labor and delivery, but you need to get in here. She looks bad. And so, you know, I start driving in, and by the time my brother and I get there, because we came in simultaneously, she was white as a ghost, was not even really coherent, and was just complaining about back pain. We were so freaked out at this point, we literally picked her up. We didn't even get a gurney. We picked her up, ran her back to the OR. We did a cesarean section.
Wow.
Delivered the baby. Baby was very pale as well, so we said, what is going on? Like, there's some bleeding somewhere, because her blood pressure's low, baby hasn't been getting enough blood. And just after we delivered the baby and handed the baby off to the pediatrician, we started to explore the abdomen, and we found what's called the retroperitoneal bleed, which is like a collection of blood in the kind of the space behind the abdomen. And so we knew that meant something in that retroperitoneal space, be it the kidneys or the spleen or something was bleeding. And so we knew if we opened it, she would bleed so significantly she might die. And so we called in the general surgeon. He took a look, and, you know, he deals with trauma and things like that. And he said, you know what? I'm not even going to open this because the bleeding's going to be so brisk. We're going to get in trouble. So we ended up packing her real tightly with just black sponges, flew her out to a a hospital where they had what's called an interventional radiologist, and they were able to investigate further, and it turned out she had what's called a renal artery aneurysm, and so her renal artery had just ruptured, and there was we've never found out why, but that was the back pain that she had been complaining of the day before. That aneurysm was probably enlarging and getting ready to rupture, and by morning time it had ruptured, and so she luckily came in just enough time we were able to save her, we were able to save the baby, and the baby's actually doing great now, and it was interesting. This was when they first started doing what's called head cooling. So now when we have premature babies or babies that they think have been compromised, they'll cool the body, but in particular the head, mm-hmm. to decrease blood supply to the brain and decrease the metabolic rate to kind of alleviate stress from the baby's system. And this was one of the first babies that they did head cooling on, and so they followed her very closely for a while to see how she did. And she's 6 or 7 now, and she's doing great.
Oh, mom's wow, doing great. That's great.
So, yeah, I mean, it's one of those stories that to this day, when I think about it, you know, I told her when I took her to my class this week, I said, you know, you very easily could, you know, not have been here, and you and this baby. And it's still, to me, an absolute miracle. And she's had 2 babies since then, and we hold our breath every time. She's done great. She's done great.
Wow, that's awesome.
That's a very inspirational story. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
So I guess we'll continue on, and if your brother can join us, then we'll continue asking him some questions. So for now, you mentioned at the beginning that being an OBGYN, you guys enjoyed it because it, you know, it involves so many different aspects. You know, it's not just gynecology and everything.
Right.
So because it encompasses more, how is it that the two of you stay, you know, stay on top of the different trends that come around in the medical industry?
There are a lot of different ways you can go about doing it. One is we're required to maintain like 4 certification, basically, and so every year the different specialty boards will send articles to like the latest research in a particular field, you know, and then you'll take an exam at the end of each year kind of reviewing that material. So the board certifying bodies will make sure that you basically get all of the latest, greatest information. Also, you know, you just subscribe to a lot of the different journals, and you read your journal articles. And the third thing, which, you know, people are back and forth on it, but it's actually drug reps as well, do keep you very well informed. They come to your office and they talk to you about the latest, greatest drugs. Now, obviously, their goal is to get you to prescribe that medication, and so you take it with a grain of salt, but they do provide a lot of up-to-date information. And so I'd say those 3 things are basically what most docs, certainly what we do to stay informed, just keep up with the board certification, study the materials that the board certifying body provides you, read the journals, and kind of keep in touch with your drug reps.
What about some shocking ones? I mean, I don't really follow the health parts of the news very often, but when I do, I see, yeah. You know, like the 3D printers are coming out, and they're actually starting to print like medicine. I'm not sure what types, but like the weird scientific stuff of the future is coming. How do you guys feel about incorporating that in however long it takes?
Oh, you know, I mean, I think the future is without a doubt going to be really exciting. You know, there are things now that they're working on that I don't think we can even conceive of, but I think the thing that I find the most promising, but also the weirdest in a way is, you know, I was reading something not too long ago about, I may use the incorrect term, but basically like little nanorobots. And so they're working on technologies that they say will one day literally be able to go into an individual cell, identify a problem like with that cell's DNA, its genetic material, and repair it. And that really is, for all intents and purposes, the holy grail, if you will, because most of these is genetic in nature. You know, be it cancer, be it a genetic propensity to heart disease, be it, you know, genetic propensity to an autoimmune disease. And so when we get to the point where we can literally identify a damaged gene, either discard it or repair it, I can't conceive of really any diseases that would be of any concern, you know? So this is the kind of, you know, technology that they're talking about, and how far off it is, you know, God only knows. But there are some really, you know, bright kids at MIT and places like that
yeah.
are working on technology like this that will truly revolutionize medicine. I can see a day and an age where, very far off, but a day and an age where there won't really be disease. There'll just be, steps taken to address disease before it ever really becomes a problem, So I think the future is very exciting. Now, that being said, I don't think that anyone will come up with a substitute for pregnancy, and so I will always be safe,
Well, I'm not going to lie. I saw an article. I don't know if they're actually going to be doing this, and I'm not sure. I don't think it was like a troll article, but possibly having, no, I think I know what it was. Transgender females being able to carry babies. Well, because I mean, they still have the reproductive system, but yeah.
So genetically a male who's, I guess it would depend. So I mean, I could see it no matter how it was done, but if you had a male who transitioned to a female, I suppose. Although, gosh, even then, I'm trying to think.
I know.
there are steps being taken. Like just this week, there was all of this talk about the uterine transplant.
Yes.
And so, who knows? There may come a time where theoretically you could transplant a uterus into a male, but even then, just the hormone production, and who knows? I suppose anything's possible, but that would take some doing.
That would take. Hopefully, it would be really interesting to see on the news someday some really cool stuff that's coming out, and just be like, "Oh, I'm alive to see that. That's awesome."
Right, for sure. I mean, I'll tell you that the things that we do now, and the way we go about approaching disease and treating conditions, I think that a generation from now, two generations from now, they're going to look back and find it comical. The leaps and the bounds that medicine is advancing by, it's truly remarkable. I mean, even in the 12 to 13 years that I've been a physician, I've seen things change so dramatically, from the Da Vinci robot to, it's amazing. And to think of where we're going to be a generation from now, two generations from now, it's almost impossible to conceive,
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So kind of on to a more personal topic, everyone knows doctors don't have a lot of free time. So how is it that you and your brother manage to balance, being a doctor and keeping up with your twin doctor's TV?
Yeah, I don't know those that well. Part of what makes it a little bit easier is we were previously in private practice where it was just he and I, and so one of us was always on, and mm-hmm. it was tougher then. But now we're part of a group, and so there are six of us who share call responsibilities and things like that, and so we're home a lot more. Basically, we cover one night a week at the hospital now versus basically having been on every night before that, and we cover one out of six weekends. And so we have a lot more free time now, and so I think that's made it easier for us to have a healthier balance, And that's just kind of the generation or the direction that medicine's heading into anyway. Now you're finding more and more practices merging and more and more hospitals employing docs, and so people are investing more time in their lifestyle and alternative endeavors. So I think being part of a group has made it a lot easier for us.
Okay. Absolutely.
So with Twin Doctors TV, how do you guys come up with which topics you want to discuss? Is it, by random or,
It is kind of random. I mean, a lot of times, we'll get an idea from, a patient encounter, maybe a question that a patient had or a unique patient experience, or sometimes it may be, like I was saying, we get the latest, greatest journal articles, and so it may be like a cutting-edge topic in medicine, or, maybe something that we encountered recently. So it's all different sources, to be honest with you. Whatever we kind of see or think about that we think, this is interesting, or this is something, patients seem to be asking about, so maybe it's something we'll discuss. Or every once in a while, we'll even have people email us and say, hey, can you talk about
something? Okay,
or sorry, cover that. Oh, he's back.
Oh,
okay.
No problem.
All over the place.
Yeah. I hope everything's all right.
Okay, so you go.
Hello?
Was it a boy or a girl, Idris?
Oh.
I don't know. Are you back, Idris? Oh, we had a mic.
Huh?
Oh, you're kind of breaking up.
Yeah.
No, I don't know. The reception in the hospital is so poor sometimes.
Yeah, well.
I'm going downtown. Okay,
there we go. Was it a boy or a girl?
It was a boy.
Yay!
That's cool. Never gets old, I tell you. It truly never gets old.
Never gets old.
Never.
Until you take them home.
Okay. So, Dr. Idris, we'll just ask you one of the more interesting questions we asked your brother, and that would be,
sure,
without revealing any names, tell us about one of your most challenging cases, and, you know, what was the woman's situation?
Well, there are a couple that kind of popped to mind. One was a patient that, and this is when I was in private practice, I think it was maybe my first year out of residency too, but I was pretty new. And Jamil was away, he was in the Army Reserve, I don't know if you guys talked about that, but he was away, so I was by myself, and I had a patient that had a really large pelvic mass. The surgeon didn't want to take her because he said, well, I think it's not surgical in nature, it's a gynae problem. But I didn't really want to take her because I said, hey, you know, I don't think I'm a gynae problem because the patient had hysterectomy. She had her uterus, tubes, ovaries, everything had been removed. But she was in pain and she had this big mass in her pelvis. So I said, well, somebody's got to take her. So I took her. and sure enough, she actually did have an ovarian mass. When they did her hysterectomy, they left her ovary behind and it developed into cancer. And, you know, anybody in GYN knows that the worst, you know, surgery to do is a surgery for ovarian cancer. But there I was, first year out of residency.
Wow.
I did it, and you know, the mortality of ovarian cancer is actually pretty high, especially when it's advanced like hers was. But you know, thankfully I was able to get the case done, and I got, you know, all the cancer that I could see out, and I sent it to radiation oncology after that, and I was like, you know, this wasn't an ideal situation. You know, hopefully she was well, but you know, her cancers aren't that great. And this has been like maybe 9 years now. And I are still Facebook friends.
Wow.
She sends me a little message every year on the anniversary of that day, just thanking me. And, you know, it was a difficult case, but it turned out well. And it's one of those cases where you really feel like you made a difference, you know?
Yeah, that's great.
You feel like you're just kind of, you know, doing cookie cutter stuff and you're not always making a difference. But that case, I really felt like I made a difference. And she's still here and we're still friends to this day. So
that's awesome.
That was one of my most challenging cases, but it ended well.
Yeah. That's awesome. So how can people find out more about you guys? What's the best way?
Well, I think if they go to our website, which is www.twindoctorscb.com. That's our medical website. If they like travel, they can go to the twindoctorstravelbag.com. We like to do travel blogging as well. And if they're in the Chicago area and they actually would like to see us, we're this physician group. They can just go to vistaphysiciangroup.com or .org. I'm not sure, but it's vistaphysiciangroup. I think it's .com, man. Yeah, and they can make an appointment.
Yeah.
Okay, so then one last question. Is there anything you'd like to share with us? You know, anything else we might not have asked that you'd like people to know?
Oh, that's a good question.
I had a bit of a good event because I don't want to repeat something you guys have already talked about.
I'm trying to think. This is very thorough. I can't think of anything.
Well, can I say one thing again?
Yeah, absolutely.
Think about. But you know, I think the take-home message that I want people to take is, you know, be it regarding, you know, PMS, dysmenorrhea, really regardless of what it is. I think the take-home message is always, 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 always seek medical care. One thing that, you know, it starts at home with my own wife, and I'm telling on her, sorry, but I find that a lot of times women put everybody else first. They put the kids first, put the husband first, they put the dog first, put the house first, and they don't always seek care when they should. So A, always seek care, talk to your doctor. B, don't just assume that it's normal. You know, I've had so many patients tell me, oh, you know, it's just quote unquote the curse, you know. I have cramps, it's just the way it is. I'm down and out for 2, 3, 4 days a month. There are tons of things that can be done. So don't assume that it's normal and not treat it. And just in general, make time for yourself, reach out to your doctor, seek care, and just take care of yourself. Those are the two big points I would really want to drive home.
Yeah, don't always trust WebMD to tell you what it is.
Definitely not. Definitely not.
Sometimes it's wrong.
Go see a professional.
Okay, then. Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Okay.